Welcome back to Therapy Insiders. I'm Dr. Gene Chirac-Abrad here with Dr. Joe Palmer. And as you guys well know, unless you don't follow sports, it is the start of baseball season with all the teams already having opening day. So Joe and I are very avid baseball fans. We used to play for a long while, and we thought it would be a good idea to talk about some very common baseball injuries and maybe a slightly different way of looking at the possible causes of them. So we'll go through some of the most common ones, starting from some shoulder pathologies. We'll talk about the elbow, and we'll look at the lower quadrant, more in the hip and pelvis. So Joe, I know you you see some youth baseball injuries, and you've treated quite a few shoulders in your day. What are some of the common things you see?
Well, I guess one of the most common injuries that I see in the youth population is what's generically called little league shoulder. Symptoms are decreased in velocity, pain in the shoulder with throwing, decreased ability to locate the ball. That kind of an injury is typically diagnosed based on the history as well as the age of your athlete, because it has to do with the epiphyseal plate and the ability for that to rotate during increased rotational strain, as with the pitching motion. But I'm not gonna go all into that. What is most important to know is that these kind of injuries should be prevented with education at the coaching level. A lot of these are overuse type injuries. Your tendonitis, is your sprains, whether that be ulnar collateral ligament or more rotator cuff strain. Those are all injuries that could be prevented with a little bit of education, I believe.
So you mentioned you kind of talked a little globally there on a syndrome essentially for youth, but that syndrome encompasses a rotator cuff pathology. It potentially encompasses a labral pathology. So in the shoulder, we have a lot of times most things are diagnosed as a tendonitis, which isn't always the case, because you have tendonitis and tendinosis, which are two vastly different things, with the tendonitis being an acute irritation of the tendon and the tendinopathy being more of a degenerative condition. So a lot of times that gets confused, especially in the rotator cuff, that if you have point tenderness over the area, it doesn't necessarily mean it's tendonitis. If anybody's treated tendonitis before, they are extremely, extremely painful. You barely have to palpate to push down on the tendon for the patient to scream in pain. I mean, you're getting barely past the superficial layer. Whereas a tendinosis, they've had that already, especially if you've been playing sports for many, many years. And once you have that initial episode, you get into that degenerative stage, and you can have flare-ups of prolonged tendinosis. And once you're in that tendinosis stage, and if you don't get it treated and rehab properly, your tissue is at a higher predisposition for strains, which a lot of times, if you think about it, if you take a step back, Joe, a strain is a tear, is it not? You have three grades of tears, and a strain would be a grade one.
That's correct. Correct.
So we have, what we want to look at is, what are some possible causes of these rotator cuff strains? Now, for a baseball player that's been playing for 4 seasons, 6 seasons, 8 seasons, 10 seasons, and all of a sudden in one of those seasons they have a rotator cuff strain, It's a hard sell to say it's overuse, because if you've been playing baseball for that long without a previous injury, it doesn't always, you can't always equate that to overuse. It's like saying, oh yeah, you have back pain, it's because you have bad posture. Well, chances are you've had bad posture for a long time. You have to figure out what in that posture is going on. Same thing here. So if we take
It's all about pitch count, Gene. It's not have you played baseball before? It's have you thrown the number of innings? Have you played on two teams? Now you're playing on three teams. It's about that change in activity level within the sport. It's not just the throwing motion. That is correlated to an overuse type injury.
That's a good point. So if we have let's say a pitcher that's been playing a regular amount, we're not talking about a reliever that's been brought in to start without building up his innings. So we're talking a very regular type of throwing, or a third baseman or a shortstop, just somebody that hasn't done something out of the ordinary, which is a good qualifier. You bring up a good point. So same starting pitcher, but the guy gets the ball every fifth day. We are, let's say, 10 starts into the season. All of a sudden, he has pain in his shoulder and gets diagnosed with rotator cuff tendonitis. Why? What can cause a rotator cuff tendonitis? We'll call it a tendonitis. Chances are, again, it's a tendinopathy of some sort. But generally, more times than not, it's diagnosed as a tendonitis. I haven't seen too many tendinosis diagnoses come my way. I don't know if you have. But let's take a step back. What could be some possible causes of a rotator cuff issue that might not be commonly looked at, aside from just saying it's overuse?
Well, I think I always start local, and I'm going to look at scapular strength.
Well, my question to you would be, why would the scapula be weak?
Why would the scapula be weak?
Yeah, you're looking at scapular strength, but why would the scapula all of a sudden be weak in a person that's 10 starts into the season?
Well, you can have a hypomobility in the thoracic spine, which is going to take a muscle that may have been in a proper, length tension, proper working scenario, and now you're looking at the origin of that muscle is not moving the way it should. You know, you're looking at that relationship being strained, which may, in essence, decrease the overall strength coming from the or overall mobility that the scapula needs in order to go through the throwing motion. Now, other than that, you're looking at things that will affect muscle activation. So you're looking at spinal level nerve roots. That's if there's no other trigger. You know, if you can't put any other, I guess, history to the injury, then that's what I'm looking at first.
Like what? Because to me, I'm looking at those things first, no matter what. To me, somebody doesn't just throw and doesn't have a deficiency in the muscle arbitrarily. Throwing to me, somebody that's been throwing, I need something more than just saying, oh, you've been throwing too much, when if that's not the case. Now, if they throw 180 pitches and they usually throw 90, that's one thing.
I like to say that most of the throwers that I look at aren't very strong posteriorly. I'll just throw that out there right now. I don't think a lot of throwers are strong, especially at the little league level. I mean, their scapular kinetics are terrible at the little league level. So, you know, I look at that as a step in prevention. Now, I'm a little late because they're already having pain, but when you look at them, you can test, and it can just be a weakness. I mean, at that level, at that young of an age, you're not talking about full skeletal maturity, and you're not talking about a fully developed throwing athlete.
Right, so you're talking developmental weakness at that stage, which I absolutely agree with. Muscles are still developing. But if we take it a little bit older, bring it up, you know, high school level, still obviously developing, but high school, college, even pros, they've reached a significant portion of their musculoskeletal maturity. I think we both know that that happens well into the 20s, but weakness doesn't arbitrarily happen. So if you're a clinician and you have somebody come in that all of a sudden have strained their rotator cuff, some of the things that, Joe brought up is you're going to look for segmental dysfunctions. So you're going to look at most likely C4, C5, C6. You're going to see if there is a segmental issue, if there is a hypomobility, if there's a hypermobility. If either one of those things are happening, you're going to have an aberrant input through that spinal level into that muscular innervation. Plus, if you, again, go down a little bit more distally into the thoracic spine needs to rotate and extend on the ipsilateral throwing side. So as you wind up that same side, all those upper to mid thoracic facet joints need to extend and rotate away. They're not. You're essentially creating a block and your shoulder complex is hitting a wall, so to speak. So if you have a segmental issue at the C-spine, you have a thoracic segmental issue. Plus, if you look at the AC joint, I know I quite often look at the AC joint. One of the indicating factors is pain at end range shoulder motion. If you have the cervical spine, thoracic spine, AC joint, and then you connect to CT junction, well, a lot of rotation happens because you need to turn your head, right, Joe? When you're throwing, when you're moving, you have a pretty quick velocity head turn, and the AC and the CT junction, excuse me, is one of the main rotating segments in the body with the AA joint and the TL junction. So you can very easily create a dysfunction at that joint without really knowing it and just throw everything else off.
Yeah, Gene, you're exactly right. And when I find a segmental dysfunction, I'm likely going to look at manipulating that joint in order to reestablish both motion at the joint, but to obtain a normal neurological input into those muscles. And then I'm going to retest to make sure that was part of the cause there. I'm always looking to try to make sure that what I'm doing is having a positive effect on what, you know, it's one thing to have a segmental dysfunction. It's another thing to correlate that segmental dysfunction with the pain that your patient's experiencing. So, I mean, that's, you know, a necessary point, I think, is that, you know, you gotta test and retest these things.
Right. That's a great point you bring up. So you can have a rotator cuff strain. You can have a rotator cuff tendinopathy and the underlying segmental issue. So the rotator cuff pathology might have already happened. Chances are it already did happen because you're seeing the patient. And you can fix that. You can still treat it with your typical techniques. But if you don't fix that underlying segmental issue, the rate of re-injury is very high in your patient. So the point we're trying to make is think a little bit deeper than just you have a rotator cuff issue. You need to go beyond and figure out why that is. And you need to look at the cervical spine, C4, 5 area. You need to look at the CT junction. You need to look at the thoracic spine. And you need to look at the AC joint. Fix that. Correct that to your manipulation if you have to, do your mobilization depending on the end feel, get the proprioceptive input in, retest. If there's segmental facilitation on top of a rotator cuff pathology, you should have a fairly quick turnaround in test retest. You should have a decrease in pain, a little decrease in tonicity in the muscle, and then add in your other, if you do soft tissue, if you do PNF, if you do other techniques, make that the next step. Make that the more the functional rehab, so to speak. And if you want to learn more about functional rehab, you can listen into our earlier podcast with Jim Meadows when we get into what function really is. Moving on, the other common issue would be in the elbow. Now we have the most widely known issue would be Tommy John surgery, which is done for the ulnar collateral ligament in the elbow or the medial portion of the elbow.
Let me stop you right there, Gene. Yeah. Let me just ask you, will Tommy John surgery make my son throw the ball faster?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. Because he's going to have unbelievable rehab done, and all his mechanics are going to get cleared up, and he's going to be stronger than before, because chances are the reason that he tore that ligament is going to get corrected during the rehab. Structurally, his elbow is going to be worse than before. You don't rebuild. The way your body is about as good as it's going to get.
I think that's important for everybody. You know, people actually, you know, they ask, and they hear these rumors, and a lot of times you just look at them and say, look, you're having serious surgery. The likelihood is that you may never throw the way you do you used to. I mean, that's the whenever you have a surgery like that. So I just right up front. Sorry to cut you off. There,
we need to
talk about that.
That's a good point. But that's usually what I tell them is, you're gonna go through a very rigorous rehab, just like you would with an ACL tear. You'll get back to, most people get back to, especially high-level athletes, Adrian Peterson being a prime example, countless of baseball pitchers being examples. They get back to, Steven Strasburg looks about as dominant as ever, doesn't he?
There's a significant difference when you're talking about professional athlete and high school athlete.
Of course. I mean, you're talking the high level of skill. You're talking many other internal factors, but there isn't a reason that you shouldn't be back to where you are, but there's plenty of reasons that you could possibly not be there. So you will work hard, but there's no guarantees. There's no guarantees after surgeries, and I think your surgeon always tells you that. But let's look at some possible causes of that ligament tear. Again, one of the most common ones is overcompensation in the elbow. So I think one of the least common assessments that people do is when you look at the elbow and you look at the ulnohumeral joint, obviously you have flexion, you have extension, anterior posterior glides, but not many people look at valgus and varus motion or abduction and adduction of the ulnum. And if the elbow gets stuck in an abducted position, or you have an abducted ulna, that can put a lot of stress on that ligament, can't it, Joe?
Well, absolutely. When you're looking at your ulnar collateral ligament and you're looking at a external rotation moment during the throwing motion, you're putting a lot of force on that ligament anyway. It's just it's an abnormal position and motion for the elbow. But add to that a hypomobility, especially into abduction of the ulna, and you're creating an increased moment at that joint, because there is no mobility or flexibility to absorb some of that rotational force.
So what we're trying to describe right now is if you straighten your arm out, straighten, extend your elbow, and you look at your arm, the angle between your humerus and your forearm, that's called a carrying angle. If that angle is too much into abduction, meaning it is more valgus, you will have more stress on that medial ligament. Now, if normally you have a normal motion at that joint, the ulnohumeral joint, into abduction and adduction, as you throw, as you're putting a ton of stress, like Joe was just saying, into external rotation and then internal rotation, that stress gets dissipated. If that ulna stuck abducted, as you throw and decelerate, that adduction moment, adduction moment, does not happen, and you are decelerating into a wall yet again. So you're putting a lot of stretch and then an abrupt stop, and the ligament does not have the full motion that it should go through into stretching and shortening. and that's a lot of force, and that can cause a lot of issues from, if you're lucky, just pain, to you do it enough times and chip away at that ligament, eventually you're going to get a tear. And I know I've seen that not only in baseball players, but tennis players, football players, anybody that has anything to do, golfers. And again, it can happen because of an abducted ulna. So you have a biomechanical dysfunction at the ulna. But here's the question that I have for you, Joe. This is the next level thought. Why does that ulna get abducted?
I'm looking at their mechanics. The ulna can get abducted by just the throwing motion itself. It doesn't have to be anything special. What are you looking at?
I'm going back to the thoracic spine. What you see is if, as they're winding up, as they're bringing back, as you're going into your backswing in golf, as you're bringing the ball back in football, as you're going up for your swing in tennis, it doesn't matter what you're doing, as you have flexion at the shoulder or abduction at the shoulder or flexion and abduction at the shoulder, your scapula will need to depress and retract. And then your thoracic spine also needs to extend and rotate at that ipsilateral side. If the thoracic spine is not extending on that side, you are not getting that full external rotation moment, and you're going to have to compensate somewhere. And that compensation is going to happen, most times happens at the elbow, because you can very easily abduct your elbow. I mean, anybody that's listening right now, you can do it yourself. Take your elbow, stabilize your humerus, and point your elbow and point your forearm away from you. Your elbow will abduct. Now, imagine that, doing that at 90 miles an hour, or doing that at 100 mile an hour tennis serve, or any other sport that you can think of. And I've seen this, and you fix the thoracic spine. I know I've had patients come to me with re-injury. I've seen other therapists, and you know, they come in with elbow pain, they come in with shoulder pain, and that's what's treated, their elbow and their shoulder. But you don't go deeper than that. You don't look at why did this happen, aside from just saying it's because they play the sport and it was overuse, or it was, you know, it was bound to happen because it just happens because they weren't ready for this, or poor training or weakness and all that stuff. So I think the big point is always asking why. Okay, they might be weak, it might be because of weakness, but why are they weak? Was it blunt trauma that caused weakness? Or was it something deeper? Weakness doesn't just arbitrarily happen. It just doesn't, unless you have some kind of pathology going on. So I'm looking at thoracic spine. Now, if the thoracic spine is cleared, if I look at it and I go, okay, hey, thoracic spine is great, then I kind of go back to what you were saying, is taking a look at their mechanics and saying, did they try something new? Did they tweak one of their pitching mechanics? Did they drop their arm slot? Did they do something like that? If the biomechanics don't add up when I'm assessing them, then I take a look. Now I'll check the biomechanics and their throwing motion either way, but I'm taking even a closer look if I don't find any biomechanical dysfunctions in the thoracic spine.
When you're looking at the thoracic spine in your throwers, how often do those segmental dysfunctions recur?
That's a great question. They recur quite often if left alone. That's why a purely biomechanical treatment is highly, highly unsuccessful in athletes that repeat the motion, because they will revert right back to what they're comfortable with, what their body's used to. If you don't retrain the neurophysiological component on top of it, you're just sending them up to fail. They'll have temporary relief and they'll revert right back. They'll come back to you. But again, I don't think that's very ethical in practice. So you go to the next level. You have your biomechanical approach, which is your joint manipulations and such, and then you do your retraining. Now, we all have our favorite retraining. I know I like to do PNF. I like to do thoracic extension exercises. What about you? Do you see a high rate of recurrence if you don't follow up with some fairly specific neuromuscular retraining?
Yeah, I frankly see a high level regardless of what retraining I do. I definitely feel like you give him a better chance if you bring in the neurophysiological component in afterwards. But getting back to mechanics, I think that it's important to note that, you know, not everybody throws with good arm elevation, with good elbow elevation. They don't have their elbow at the highest point when their lead foot contacts the ground. You get a lot of kids that are throwing from sub 90-90 positions. I mean, they're not even clearing shoulder height with their elbow when they're coming through. Those all told put a lot more stress on the elbow, because you're not letting the shoulder and the scapula absorb the force of the throwing motion. You're not letting that shoulder do its job. So all of the force is going through the elbow first before it hits the shoulder. And so, yes, I completely agree with what you're saying, that in order for you to have a good motion, you need the rotation and you need all of your segments working. But you also need to know what a good pitching motion looks like.
Absolutely. I should probably clarify, you can't have one without the other. You can't know that you have a dysfunction if you don't have a good throwing mechanic, because you will never find out, because chances are you'll never repeat the motion. You'll never find out which joints are being stressed and if they are. So absolutely, you need to clean up the mechanics. You need to clean up the joints. I think that's the main point in our discussion, is you need to combine and you need to dig a little deeper than just one or the other. And you need to go a little bit more than the superficial. This is what they have. We're just going to do some strengthening exercises. They're going to get stronger, and this is all going to be better. And it might be, but you're putting a Band-Aid on a surgical incision, and it doesn't work. Eventually, it'll bleed again, right? You need to go deeper. You need to figure out what the underlying cause is. Now, you bring up another level. Another pretty good point is, we've talked about the upper half, but the lower quadrant is very important, not only in running and push off and all that. It relates to the upper quarter as well. So I know I see a ton of pelvic asymmetries going on, which can be very widely problematic for a lot of issues. What kind of things do you see as a result of pelvic asymmetries, Joe?
Muscle strains. That's the biggest one. You're asking your muscles to perform, but you're not allowing them their proper length tension based on that asymmetry. So that's the biggest one that I see. You also, anytime you have an asymmetry, you're going to have a limitation in range of motion at some place, right? So and why that's important is because there are different motions that are stressed and in the throwing mechanics. And if you're losing motion in a lower extremity joint, it will be compensated for, and it may be compensated for in one of those areas of rotation that Gene was talking about earlier. You may find compensation in your pelvis, that, or in the TL junction, or even further up in the spine. But those two, if you're talking about lower extremity, you're talking about finding a compensatory dysfunction based on a limitation. I mean, let's talk about the hip a little bit, Gene. What is the most important motion in the throwing athlete hip?
The most important motion, which could be a controversial topic, but the one motion that I'm looking at, more of a quadrant, is I really need to see internal rotation in these athletes, in runners, in throwing, batting athletes, because you're putting essentially a single leg full weight on that hip. And the internal rotation is the force dispersion from the hip through the ground reaction forces. So if I don't have good internal rotation at the hip, then you're going to have compensation. And most times than not, that compensation is wearing away at the acetabulum, at the labrum. Obviously, the other motions are important. You know, hip extension is very important. Hip flexion, obviously, but hip flexion a lot of times is the compensation motion. So I really want to see internal rotation. What about you?
Yeah, when you talk about your follow through, the throwing athlete, your leg is going to be planted on that landing foot, and your whole body is rotating on top of your leg and your hip, and that force is into internal rotation. You're coming across your body, and you're going to cause an internal rotation moment at the hip. If you don't have that internal rotation, then where is that follow through gonna start from, you know?
Yeah, you're start wearing away at the structure that's not really designed. So you have a available motion at the hip joint itself with the femur rotating on that acetabulum, and if you don't have that internal rotation for various reasons that we'll hit on, you're going to stress another part of the labrum. You do it enough times and you'll either get impingement, labral impingement, femoral acetabular impingement if you have arthritic buildup, or you'll get a tear. Now, to take a step back, Joe, we talk about asymmetries. We should probably clarify what asymmetries are and how to properly look at them. So most people, when they look at asymmetries, will put a patient supine, palpate their ASIS, and say, hey, one's higher than the other, one's lower than the other. You really don't know which is which, right? You really don't know if one's higher or the other one's lower. And the way you really find out is by doing your palpatory glides and you're assessing end feel. So you want to know how it feels at end range. You want to know if that innominate is gliding into flexion or extension, or posterior glide, anterior glide, in terms of other terminology. So that's what I'm doing. I'm gliding flexion, extension, left and right while stabilizing the contralateral ASIS. And once I find out the limitation, once I find out either a stiff end feel or a jammed end feel, that's when I can say, okay, now we have an asymmetry because of end feel, not because they look not even. Do you follow that same mindset?
I do. I feel like either way you have an asymmetry. You just don't know which one's the culprit until you get the end feel. But either way you have an asymmetry. If you've determined you have an asymmetry, it's then about which one. Nobody's perfect. I mean, I sometimes think that I've done my test and that it's definitely the right side that is the culprit, and you know, come to find out that it was the left side after all, and sometimes to reestablish that the mobility through those segments, you may have to manipulate them both.
Right, doesn't happen very often. It's usually a unilateral issue, as you can look at a lot of these issues. If you look at baseball and a lot of hamstring strains, a lot of adductor strains, which a lot of times are misdiagnosed as quad strains, you're talking a unilateral issue. And if you look at your patients and they're on the table and you do your assessment and then you do your straight leg raise and you find a unilateral tightness, what's perceived as tightness, and you know the universal thing with a straight leg raise is, of course, you have a disc issue. But that's not always the case. You can have a unilateral issue. You can have hamstring, quote-unquote, tightness. You can have gastroc, quote-unquote, tightness. But if it's unilateral, it could very well be against segmental facilitation, just like we talked about at the thoracic spine, at the cervical spine. If you have an issue at the SI joint, which I know in my experience, most people that come through have some sort of issue, you're talking S1, S2 nerve level. So if you have an issue at S1, S2, you're talking hamstrings, you're talking gastrocs. When those segments are facilitated, they're essentially always at a firing potential. It's like flexing a bicep, constantly walking around with that, and then trying to lift a grocery bag full of groceries, and you strain your bicep, and you go, hey, well, why the heck did I just strain my bicep all of a sudden? Well, because your bicep has been on constantly for God knows how long because of facilitation. So I'm always taking a step back and saying, how is this relevant to the possible pathology and I need to fix it so it doesn't happen again. Because more times than not, as you mentioned, Joe, in prevention, we don't get our hands on these people early enough to have a preventative screen, to have a preventative joint assessment to make sure there is no facilitation. By the time they get to us, the best we can do is hope that we can prevent it from happening again. So we just talked about S1, S2, but if you look at the lumbar spine, I know you mentioned TL junction. I mean, that can cause issues at the hip flexors and hip as well, right?
Absolutely. You're looking at TL junction. You're looking L1, L2, innervating hip flexors, possibly that aberrant input facilitating either side there, correlating in a increased tightness of the hip flexors or a decrease in extension on that side. You got to look at it from both angles. And, you know, tightness in a muscle is one thing, really what you're missing because of that tightness is the motion in the opposite direction, right? So
exactly.
So that's the important piece of finding a facilitated segment or a segment that may be chronically tight. You have to get to it and address it so that you regain the opposite motion.
Absolutely. So here's my challenge to you guys who's listening out there. We talked a lot about this, and if you stretch people all the time, you know my views if you've listened to the previous episodes. I think for most purposes, stretching is a practice in futility. It's a waste of time. Joe has a slightly different opinion, and which makes sense as well. But here's my challenge to you. You have a patient. All of you will have this patient at some point with either glute med weakness, so their hip abduction is not very strong, or they have a unilateral tightness in their hamstrings, an extensibility issue, or their gastrox. Before stretching them or before doing the test again, if you have an issue with glute med weakness, go to their L4, L5 segment and wobble it, meaning grade 3 oscillations in that segment, and retest their strength again and see what happens. If you have hamstring tightness unilaterally, check out their SI joint, give them the same wobble, P to A, give it about 15, 20, 30 seconds, and retest that extensibility again and see what happens. If you get more range of motion, chances are it's a segmental facilitation. If you have stronger retest of the hip abductors, chances are, or more than chances are, it is segmental facilitations. I do it all the time. It's a quick and easy way to prove to your patients that if they come into you with hip pain, why you're looking at though, if they're at their low back, if they come into you with distal knee pain, why are you wobbling my ass? Show them, retest, and they will be amazed. I do it all the time. They buy in, they understand what you're doing after that, and they trust you. Do you do some of that, Joe?
I do. I know you keep going back to the stretching thing.
I just keep jabbing to see if
I know. Hey, I think you got to have a full program. I think you got to, you know, you don't just have somebody come into you with the biceps that is turned on, or a hamstring that's turned on for, we're not talking about hours here. We're talking about days. We're talking about months that they've been walking around with this kind of a facilitation. And I think it's a naive thing to think that all you have to do is reestablish appropriate neurological input and that it's going to fix the prolonged shortening by doing that. I think it can have an effect, and I think it does have an effect, and I think it's important to do that. But I think then you also need to reestablish what normal is, and to me, stretching is the way to do that.
Well, first of all, I've been called much, much worse than naive even today. So that's on the better things on my list. But you know, I do disagree with that point. I think you do not get shortening from, if it's a facilitated segment, you get shortening, you get contractures. If you're immobilized for long whiles, if you're a fully functioning person,
that's what you're talking about, though, Gene. You're talking about prolonged periods of shortening. That if a facilitated segment allows, it does enough to contract the muscle, then contraction as a definition is a shortening. So you're talking about a prolonged period of shortening.
But you're not talking about a contracture. The person can still move the muscle. The person can still function. They just have a increased hypertonicity of that muscle. So once that signal causing that hypertonicity is resolved, then the muscle is resolved.
The muscle immediately functions the way it did 2 months ago.
It does. It functions. It's not 100%. I'll give you that, but
there's no I'm not talking about contracture type adhesions. There's no adhesions. There's no nothing because of the movement in that muscle. Is that what you're saying?
That is exactly what I'm saying. There are no adhesions. What is an adhesion, Joe? You're talking, at the microscopic level, you're talking what, myosin, actin, you're talking sarcomeres. I think once you start moving, I think any of those adhesions, once that input is gone, you'll get it back. Now you can stretch, you can do the stretch, but I think there are more effective things than stretching to regain whatever limitation is left, if it's still limited, and that you're talking PNF, hold, relax, all those things. You can still do it with stretching, but I think it's not as effective as some other techniques out there. So you heard our conversation, our discussion on the topic. We want to hear yours. Joe and I have our own ways of treating patients after we clear up the segmental facilitation, but we both agree that it needs to be cleared up. You need to fix the underlying cause. You need to figure out what the underlying cause is, and you need to think deeper than just superficially, this is what they have. You need to think of why they have it, is what we've been trying to really get through in this episode. Try the wobble, find out the level innervation, give them a grade 3 oscillation, see what happens, retest their extensibility, retest their strength. Let us know how it turns out. Check us out at therapyinsiderspod.com. Leave a comment on the forum, leave us a comment on iTunes, and we will keep following up on things you guys tell us, things you guys want to hear. We are looking forward to more feedback from you guys. Thus far, it's been great hearing from some of you guys and the positive things you've had to say. So thank you very much to those guys that have reached out to us. As always, Joe and I are available by email, therapyinsiders@gmail.com. Any last remarks, Joe?
No, you said it all. Dig deeper, man. Dig deeper.
There you go. We'll see you guys in our next episode. Thanks for listening.